Welcome to Urban Dharma, the podcast, where suffering is optional. Hi, this is Reverend Kusla coming to you from downtown Los Angeles. It's supposed to be a rainy day today, but so far the sun is out and shining. Last night I took my motorcycle down to Long Beach, California to interview an old friend, Reverend Tenzin Kacho. She has been ordained as a Buddhist nun now for over 21 years. And I wanted to speak to her about why she became a Buddhist and why she became a Buddhist nun and the kind of work she's been doing since she's been a Buddhist nun. This is a little longer interview than I normally do, but she had so many interesting stories and things to talk about, it was hard to cut it off short. So what we're looking at is about an hour and 14 minutes of Tenzin Kacho speaking about what it means to be a Buddhist nun in America. So without further introduction, here is my interview with Venerable Tenzin Kacho. Okay, this is Reverend Kusla talking to Venerable Tenzin Kacho in Long Beach, California. I first met Venerable Tenzin Kacho in 1994 at the International Buddhist Meditation Center. We were both there for a grand ordination, and I was being ordained as a novice monk, and she was becoming ordained as a bhikkhuni, a fully ordained nun in the Vietnamese Zen tradition. And that was the first time I met her, and we struck up a friendship that has lasted until today, which is in April 1st, 2006. So she kindly consented to allow me to interview her about being a Buddhist, about being a Buddhist nun in America. So, Tenzin Kacho, the first question I'd like to ask you is, why did you become a Buddhist? What was the turning point in your life? What did you read or what did you see that made a difference?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to do this. Why I became a Buddhist, or what first inspired me, was meeting a friend named Ward Holmes, who had been gone for many years studying in India, and I was friends with people who lived on the property of his family. And after years of knowing my friends and going to visit them at their home, one day Ward had returned from India. And I was so struck by his presence, his interest and love of his teachers and the Dharma, that I had to find out more. And he was only there for a short while, so I just started devouring everything I could on Buddhism, and particularly the Buddhism of Tibet.
Do you remember what the first book was that you read about Buddhism? Was it a sutta or a book about Buddhism?
I believe it was a sutta. And actually, even before I met Ward, I had picked up the Words of the Buddha, a little text that I found in a Buddhist temple in Hilo, Hawaii, where my daughter was attending preschool. And I just started questioning things that were going on in my life. And so this little text, the Words of the Buddha, just spoke to me, and it was that, and another little trigger, I should say, was taking a course in comparative English, and we were comparing the poetry of a Zen master and the singer Bob Dylan. And I found the exercise very interesting in examining the words and the import of their words. So those things really started waking me up to the Dharma.
And then Ward came into your life, and he was a person who was actually practicing.
Exactly.
And that then you said, I need to find out more. That was like a real turning point in your life. Now, because you were born and raised in Hawaii, Buddhism, I guess, is very much a part of Hawaii, isn't it?
Yes.
It's been there for a while, and yet you hadn't been to a Buddhist temple.
I have been to many Buddhist
you
temples,
have.
Actually.
Okay.
And the curious situation was that my family background is Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And there were Japanese and Chinese Buddhist temples all over Hawaii that were very, very beautiful. Many of them handmade structures with beautiful curving roofs and carvings. And I was very drawn to those as well. But when I would go to the temples for services, and they were primarily funeral services, the monks or the priests, I should say, would be chanting these sutras, and they would take a long time, and I would say a long time in the mind of a young child sitting on a hard pew.
Yes.
It would just seem very long. And I can remember asking my father what the priest was saying. And it rather made me feel a bit disgruntled that what the problem was that the priests were chanting sutras in Sanskritized Japanese.
Ah.
So my dad couldn't understand what they were saying, and so it left me completely clueless. So we would just sit through these long, long engagements. So because of that, it did not really open me up until later when I started reading some translations.
And after the meeting with Ward and seeing an actual practicing Buddhist, then did you seek out a center? Did you decide, I'm going to meditate now? Or did that come later? Or because you said you went to find some more books, you wanted to read about it, you wanted to find out more about it. When did you first start to meditate? And what was the reason for that?
Uh-huh. Actually, I started exploring everything I could after that, reading everything, going to all kinds of centers, whether they were Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, going to hear lectures by different people who had come through and lecture in Hawaii on all different philosophies and religions, and I loved it. But the idea of practice and meditation did not really really settle in me for a long while. And I guess where it really started becoming stronger as a field of practice for me was when I finally had an opportunity to move to a temple in Hawaii that was being resuscitated, renovated. It had been abandoned for many years, and it was going to be reestablished as a Tibetan Buddhist center after being a Japanese Nichiren center, abandoned after the sugar cane companies had consolidated their little towns, and this one was just left empty for many, many years. And it was there that I started studying what is called the Lamrim, which in Tibetan means the graduated Lam is path, so the graduated path to enlightenment. And those teachings were very, very powerful for me.
Now, with all the different kinds of Buddhism that we have in the world today, and we had back then as well, what drew you to Tibetan tradition, the Vajrayana tradition?
Well, I could say that one was, it was a little exotic. It was a faraway land. It was with the Tibetan people who were living in exile in India and Nepal. Something on my own turf with the Japanese and Chinese temples just seemed perhaps too close. I don't know. But also there was this quality in my friend Ward, who had studied with the Karmapa, the previous Karmapa, and how he, whenever he would speak about his teacher, tears would flow from his eyes. And I just thought it was so unusual for a man to cry about his relationship with his teacher. And so this was one thing that made me inquire about the Tibetan Buddhist path, because they speak so much about the importance of the teacher. That was one thing.
Okay. So you were practicing, you were studying, you chose the Tibetan style of Buddhism, and you became, I guess, a layperson. Did you take precepts? Did you take a name on?
Yes, I did.
You did,
but not for a while.
Okay.
I studied at this temple in Hawaii for a year, and then the Karmapa was making a tour of the United States. So there he did give refuge precepts, but I didn't take them at the time. To me, taking the precepts, the refuge precepts, was something so important, and I wanted to be very sure in doing them that I did not take the precepts, even though they were offered in California. And during that visit, it was kind of a pilgrimage where we followed the Karmapa from San Francisco, and we drove all the way up into Vancouver, Canada. Mm. And finally in Canada, I did take refuge with the Karmapa, and I received a name. They did a little clipping of the hair that they do when they give the refuge ceremony. And so it was there that I was launched, so to speak.
Wow. Now, at that point in your life, were you living in the States on the 48, I guess?
I was actually on my way to Boulder, Colorado, to live in Boulder and to study with Trungpa Rinpoche, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche.
And you remember what year this is?
That was 1974.
Okay.
And so I had taken refuge precepts. I had met Trungpa Rinpoche in San Francisco, and I asked him, where could I go? I wanted to study with him, because in Hawaii, there was no teacher. Mm-hmm. We were just studying some teachings that were being sent and had been recorded from India.
Okay.
So... So 1974, I made my way to Boulder, Colorado, and studied for a few months with Trungpa Rinpoche.
And as you look back in 1974, what was your take on Buddhism? Was it pretty mystical, schmystical at that point? Not mainstream, not a lot of books out?
With Tibetan Buddhism?
With Tibetan Buddhism?
It was very new to me.
Okay.
But I was astounded by the number of people who showed up to see the Karmapa.
Hmm.
I was born and raised in Hawaii, so I really did not have too much experience of living on the in the continental U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So when we landed in San Francisco, the Black Crown ceremony that the Karmapa was giving was held in one of these big shipping warehouses along the docks in San Francisco, and there were several tens of thousands of people there.
Wow.
I was quite amazed to see so many people there for this. So being mystical, the ceremony of the Black Crown was something quite unusual and different. I attended it, but I did not, I was quite interested in who he was as a person, but I think they say that you need special kind of connection with this to really see what he's holding there as this mystical crown. And I tend to be much more, I would say, down to earth, practical, down to earth, rather than on the mystical side.
Okay, so now you're in Boulder, Colorado.
So I went to Boulder, Colorado.
And you're staying with Trungpa?
Yes.
At that point, how long did you stay with him?
Until January of 75. So I studied with him for about 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
And I loved his teachings. His teachings were fantastic. Yeah. I found him very creative, innovative, going to the heart. His book, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism,
yes,
had just come out.
Okay.
I found that a seminal text for us as Westerners. Really enjoyed his talks. What was confusing for me was the community and the conduct of the community.
Mm.
Because there was a lot of carousing and a lot of drinking and what seemed like a lot of womanizing. And I was living there with my daughter, who was 5.
Mm.
And found also that it was very expensive to go to his talks. I had to find a sitter or to take her with every time. The teachings would be billed for 7:30 or 8 o'clock, but he wouldn't show up till 10. Mm-hmm. And he would expect us to sit there quietly until he showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just found that confusing.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was perhaps what you could say skillful means in his style of doing what he was doing and the way he was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was confusing to me to be listening to someone teach while smoking cigarettes and perhaps manifesting drunkenness, even though the teachings were so clear and wonderful. But I had, the seed had already been planted for me to go to India.
So is this when you decided to go to India after
you
left him?
Yes, it was a decision.
In Colorado?
Yes,
okay.
It was a decision. And I actually asked him that question, too.
Hmm.
I said,
what did you say to him?
It took me 4 months to get an interview with him.
Mm.
And so I asked, I am enjoying your classes, but I'd also really like to study in India. And I have an opportunity to make money to go to India by going to work in Alaska.
Mm.
So what do you think about all this? And he just said, why don't you go on retreat? So I went to Shambhala, what is now called Shambhala Mountain Center, in the dead of winter, and did a 10-day solitary retreat in Shamatha, just watching my breath for a minimum of 8 hours a day in a solitary cabin through a blizzard.
Wow.
And for a girl from Hawaii, that was quite a different experience. So I'll never forget that retreat.
Yeah.
And it was very, very simple. I just heated the one little room with a wood stove and stoke it up in the morning and start a pot of brown rice on top of the stove and cook some brown rice. And I had raw carrots and brown rice for 10 days.
Wow.
Bathed once by rolling in the snow.
Wow. So it was in this retreat that you decided India was calling you.
To go on to India.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you went to Alaska first to make some money?
Yes, I drove to Alaska from Boulder, Colorado.
Wow.
And really encouraged several friends from the Boulder community and met some friends from the Hawaii community to meet me, and my sister came up as well. So there were a whole lot of us that went up to Fairbanks, Alaska to strike it rich with that black gold.
Ah, the oil, huh?
Yes.
Working for the oil
companies. Yes, the oil oil pipeline was coming in.
Yeah.
Several of the people went out on the line to build it, and I was just interested in making enough money to go to India.
Hmm.
So I never went out on the line. I just worked as 2 to 3 jobs at a time.
Okay.
Doing waitressing or working in a health food store and shipping supplies out from an office supply company out onto the pipeline. So made a little stash.
And how long did it take you to make enough money to go to India?
I was there 9 months.
Okay.
And in 9 months, I afforded a trip to Hawaii and back twice.
Uh-huh.
And also a six-month visit to India.
Wow. And did you take your daughter with you to India?
No, my daughter stayed with my ex-husband in Hawaii.
Okay.
And I was able to go and study in India.
Wow. So now, did you go to Dharamsala?
I went to Dharamsala. We went by coal train across India from Calcutta all the way to New Delhi and up to Pathankot, and then by bus up into the Himalayan mountains.
Wow.
Yes.
And what kind of living arrangements did you have while you were there?
I rented a tiny little room that was so tiny that it had a little door and a big window. And it was barely as long as I was tall.
Wow.
And it was just maybe 2 inches higher than I was tall.
Wow.
And it had a little shelf in it.
Like a little cell.
It was a little cell.
Yeah.
But I could throw open this big window and look out at the mountain range and the valley below. So it was very, very beautiful. Mm. And where I was going to study was at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, which had just opened in 1972, I believe. Mm-hmm. 71, perhaps. And I wanted to study there with Venerable Geshe Nawang Darge.
Mm.
And it was actually he in 1975 who suggested that I become a nun.
Okay, yeah, I was curious about that. So now you're in India and you're studying.
I'm studying.
And so this monk says to you, have you ever thought about becoming a nun?
Why don't you become a nun?
And what was your first thought when you said that? Were you thinking in that direction?
Not at all.
Okay.
My daughter was 6.
Yeah.
And I was totally taken aback by what he said.
Yeah.
And replied that that would be very difficult, it might be hard, I have a young daughter. But he said that to me after I'd been studying with him for about 3 or 4 months. And at that point, we broke for winter break.
Now, do you think he saw something in you?
I think so.
Okay.
I really believe so, because he did not say things like that to just anybody. Mm-hmm. He was very careful. Well, he was very clear with what he said to everyone.
Yeah.
In his way of teaching and his conduct. And so I went on pilgrimage for about 6 weeks, perhaps, all over the Buddhist holy places. So we went to Sarnath, where the Buddha first taught the five disciples. We went to Bodh Gaya, where he attained enlightenment. Went to Lumbini, which is now within the borders of Nepal, so changing borders. And that is where the Buddha was born. And to Kapilavastu, where the Buddha passed away into Parinirvana. So we went on all these holy places. And then I stayed in a tent on top of the Tibetan temple for about a month, 3 weeks or a month, in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha attained enlightenment. And every day I would go to sit under the Bodhi tree, which is the descendant of the tree that the Buddha attained enlightenment under.
Yeah.
And thought about what my teacher said and read over my notes and also studied with the first, the senior tutor of the Dalai Lama, Ling Rinpoche.
Okay.
Studied with him. And then we went back to Dharamsala when the new season began, new season of classes. And those days, the classes were long. We had 3 classes a day, 6 days a week.
Wow.
So we were quite busy.
Yeah.
And in 75, when we were there, although the Tibetans had come out in 1959 after the diaspora, it was still very, very poor. People would stand in line at a community water tap and wait for a little water and wash their pots and pans with ashes. There were no toilets to speak of. We just would go find a shrub somewhere. And it was hard.
Yeah.
It was hard. I would go.
What kind of food did you eat when you were there? Did you eat what the other students ate?
Yeah, I was vegetarian.
Okay.
And I was a little afraid to eat the meat because it would hang on hooks with flies buzzing all around them.
Yeah.
And so we would prepare our own food or sometimes go into little restaurants and buy some noodles, noodles and tea.
Okay.
So that's what we ate. And speaking of the meat, you know, at first they used to slaughter the sheep and goats down below and haul them up to McLeod Ganj, where we used to live, where the big Tibetan community is. But then the butchers got smarter, I guess, and had the animals walk up the hill.
Save them the work, huh? Yeah.
And so every morning we could hear the animals
being slaughtered,
screaming before being slaughtered.
Did you say prayers for them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And my same teacher, Geshe Darge, suggested that we actually go and observe the event.
Yeah.
So one morning we did go to watch what they were doing to the animals. And that was very provocative.
Yeah, what an eye-opener.
Yeah.
The suffering of the animals, but also the suffering of the people killing the animals.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Creating
karmic consequences for themselves and others.
So. Right, but, you know, because of the market was there.
Yeah.
For the meat eaters.
Yeah.
Where were we?
Well, what an experience. But now you still haven't become a nun. You've been thinking about it. You've been taking classes.
Right.
And so what was the turning point? When did you decide that he was right?
Well, during my...
I should become a nun.
Yes. During my pilgrimage to these holy places, I recollected his teachings about you've attained this wonderful human birth. This is your precious opportunity to really practice. What else is more important than really cultivating and developing your spiritual practice? And so I thought about it, and after I returned from our pilgrimage, I made an appointment to see him. And told him that I'd been thinking about his suggestion that I become a nun, and told him I would like to do that. And it was translated to him, and his reply came back, "It might be difficult, you have a young daughter."
The same things you said.
The same things I said. And then he said, "It would be wonderful." Mm-hmm. It would be wonderful. However, the point of becoming a nun did not happen for another 10 years.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, another 10 years. And I'm so glad that I had those 10 years. It was like a consideration put on the back burner of my life. And during those 10 years, I engaged in a lot of things. After I moved back from India, I was in Hawaii and we were studying with different teachers.
Okay.
And then I moved to California and started studying with Geshe Gyaltsen, who's I'm working with still. And
so it wasn't like your practice and study stopped for those 10 years. You were still actively pursuing study and practice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Actively studying. But also my daughter was growing up. And then there was a young man who became a monk here at our center. And when he did that...
And when you say our center, which we're now sitting in...
We're sitting
in. And it is called...
Tupten Darge Ling.
Okay, and it's
Land of Buddha's Teachings. It's now situated in Long Beach, California.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So this man became a monk, and it reignited my long-ago aspiration to
And was this man an American?
He was an American.
Okay.
Right.
So you were seeing Americans getting ordained.
Yes.
In some respect. And that, and then you thought to yourself, maybe, well, why not me?
Yes, right. Okay. Again, thinking about how short our lives are, mm-hmm. actually. And the older I get, the shorter it seems.
Mm-hmm. For good reason.
And the precious opportunity of being able to study and practice
yes.
as a monastic is so rare and so so special.
Well, if I could just interrupt for a second.
Yeah.
I remember with great fondness what Geshe Gelson said about that. I was traveling with him and other monks and nuns up to Vajrapani for a monastic conference. I think it was the second monastic conference. And he was asked to speak. And somehow I went with the group, with him up there. And we stopped off at a restaurant on the way to have some food. And we're sitting, eating. And he was talking about Western monastics. And he said, Western monastics are like white crows. And I still remember that to this day. How rare Western monastics are. Mm-hmm. And he recognized that too.
Yeah. But what he says now is not so rare.
Okay, good. Good. There are more white crows now. That's good. Good.
Or maybe not so many white crows, but more Western monastics.
Oh, good. Wonderful.
Yes.
So how did you get ordained then? Did you approach a teacher and
yes.
say, I want to be ordained?
I did. I really wanted to be ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Mm.
I felt that I would keep my promise and my vows so much more closely, more precious, because of my esteem for him as a teacher, as a monastic, as an exemplary figure of how to practice and lead my own life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote a letter to him asking if I could be ordained by him. And in 1975, when I first thought about it, he was not ordaining, at least not women at that time. But by 1985, when I was finally ordained, and I had written the letter about a year ahead in advance, requesting this, and so it was set up, and I went back to India to mm-hmm. be ordained by him.
Now, as a woman, what do you see as some of the unique challenges when you became ordained, mm-hmm. as compared to a guy mm-hmm. like myself?
Well,
you had to cut off your hair. Was that traumatic? Had you thought about that?
No. Yes, I had thought about it,
okay.
but I didn't feel it was particularly traumatic.
Okay.
One thing that I also organized was that after I was ordained, I would enter a nunnery in India because I wanted other monastic examples around me.
Other monastic women around you.
And the monastic community around me.
Yes.
So that I could have many teachers in that sense,
yeah.
so to speak, of how they live their lives as monastics. So I also requested entry into a Tibetan nunnery in Dharamsala.
Okay.
And lived with them for about 6 months that time.
Wow.
And
was it a hard life in the nunnery?
It was.
Did you have a lot of work and study and practice?
Okay. I had a lot of challenges because at that point I did not speak Tibetan.
Okay.
And I was also practicing not eating after noon.
Mm.
And I was also vegetarian in a non-vegetarian community.
Wow.
Sometimes I would not have anything except rice. And they'd want to put a whole lot of sugar on top of it to maybe sweeten my meal, I guess.
I'll give you energy, maybe.
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to eat the sugar.
Did you have any health problems because of that?
Occasional colds.
Okay.
It's very cold in the Himalayan foothills in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And, so otherwise, no, I was quite good, healthy, and I loved living there. Challenges were more with some of my food and not being able to speak to people.
Did any of the nuns speak English?
There were two nuns who spoke English at the time.
Okay.
But they were very busy and had other duties. I was not busy doing chores because my teacher, Geshe Gyaltsen, had arranged it for me to be what's called a chunze, which is where you make a special exception and offerings to the nunnery to be able to be excused from the ordinary duties. And I think this has good points and bad points,
mm-hmm.
because in jumping in and doing all the activities with the nuns, then I would probably have learned much more about their lifestyle rather than being exempt from it all. However, because I was only there 6 months, it gave me that much more time to devote to study and learning the language and acclimatizing myself to the situation of living there and being a monastic.
So. Now, what comes to my mind, and after speaking to people in the Tibetan tradition who went to India to become ordained, what do you do next? I know a lot of people who are ordained don't have any place to go. You know, they go there, they're excited about Buddhism, they're excited about the ordination process, they get their ordination, but they don't have a temple to go to, they don't have a center to go to, they don't have a community to go to.
Yes.
Did you have some place to go in America after your ordination?
I came back here to the center, which was at that point in West LA.
Okay.
And actually had to go out and go to work because my monies were all used up.
And the center couldn't support you?
The center could not support me, so I would put on lay clothes every day and go and work as a bookkeeper in different corporations.
Okay.
And then come back and put my robes back on.
Okay.
I believe situations are getting better for monastics in general, and also feel that we're becoming a little more careful about informing those who wish to be ordained what is in store for them, and to really look a little more broadly as to what their opportunities and placement could be as a monastic. I think we have to be cognizant that of really, really checking our motivation for becoming monastics, because sometimes we just want to be taken care of.
Yeah.
And monasteries tend to be very busy places and requiring a lot of cooperation among the residents.
Yeah.
So I believe the selection process and the weeding out process is becoming clearer and much better for everyone concerned. In the East, and I haven't been back to Dharamsala in a while, except for South India, but in northern India, I believe the Western monastics are much more organized now, and there are plans to build a Western monastery which would house both female and male monastics.
Wonderful.
And the Dalai Lama is endorsing this and really guiding it a lot. he himself has so many disciples around the world now, and I'm so heartened by his taking a very hands-on interest in guiding the Western monastery in India. So,
what were some of your duties? Now, you worked during the week, and I imagine you were at the center during the weekend wearing your robes. Did you have a Sunday service? Did people come to meditate in the evenings? Were you able to lead that, or were you teaching some of the lay people about Buddhism at the center when you came back from India?
Yes, when I came back, I didn't teach initially, but slowly it started occurring. Teaching on occasional Sundays, I started a little children's class, working in meditation with children. Started a bookstore in West LA. We had an apartment building, so I was also managing the apartment building, and really taking on too many things. I think there is a percentage of monastics who tend to take on too many things.
Do you find them burning out?
I think there is that potential.
Okay.
In different ways.
Yeah.
And then having to step back and reassess. We all have our own particular learning styles or tendencies of doing things. So I was one of those who was really taking on too much.
And what did you decide to give up then? When that came to you and you said, I'm just doing too much and I can't do any of it.
One way I would handle it would be to take occasional forays back to my nunnery.
And was that like a retreat for you?
It was really like a time of deepening my practice.
Okay.
I would get up very, very early in the nunnery, like at 3 or 3:30, and it was such a pristine, quiet time without the din of the community being so busy.
Yeah.
So I treasured those early morning hours and would do some practice and meditation. And then I would walk down the hill to the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. I started attending the classes there again and studying 5 days a week at this library, and participating with the nuns quite a bit too this time, these other times. So just being with the nuns and having the opportunity to study, practice. I would also teach English to the nuns.
And were you speaking Tibetan at this point?
Yes, my Tibetan really increased. A little sidebar, one of the ways it increased was while I was in California here, I took on a project of going on a monastic tour and being the coordinator for a tour. And we went to 11 countries over 13 months. And it was like a goodwill tour on one hand, but also to help raise funds to build a new temple for the monastery in South India. And we were accomplished all of those things. It was great. And so my Tibetan language picked up very well during that, and also living with the nuns in India.
So, now you're at the La Cienega Center, and then you moved from there to this center in Long Beach. Was that the next move? You sold that
with
and bought
this?
A couple transitions.
Because what happened in West LA were the LA riots.
Oh yeah.
After the Rodney King incident.
Was that 94? Am I close on that?
I can't remember the exact date.
I can't either.
That was one, and the other thing was the earthquake. That really rattled Santa Monica and West LA. And our building slipped off its foundation while we were in it. It was very frightening. So those two events precipitated a need to move. Another event where I was alone in the whole building was a foiled drug bust outside our window, and I heard gunshots and watched two boys die outside my window. So I really agreed with everyone that it was time to move to a better place.
So, but
the transition didn't go as quick, easily as from here to one spot to another, because we had to determine how to dissolve that building, mm-hmm. and where were we going to move. So we lived in a trailer for a little while in a canyon in Malibu, thanks to a friend. And then we moved, we rented an apartment for a short while, and Geshe-la taught all over LA because we had no regular teaching place. Mm-hmm. And people would open up their martial arts centers for us, both in Pacific Palisades and in Atwater Village. Wow. And people's homes. We would teach in different people's homes until we finally got this place in 1997.
Okay. This is a wonderful place.
Yes.
Yes. Then you moved in here, and then you decided, I don't know if you decided, but somebody decided it was time for you to have your own place, mm-hmm. or become a teacher in
yes.
your own right. And there was a group in Colorado Springs, Colorado,
yes.
that said, please send her up here. We want her as our teacher.
Right. They were asking for a resident teacher, and I chose to take on the post.
Okay.
And that was in 98, I believe.
Yes.
Yes. Prior to that, I'd been hopping around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
One of my mentors is Venerable Thubten Chodron.
Oh, yes.
Who was really encouraging me to teach. And so I was spending a lot of time with her in group retreats or at her center in Seattle. And so I also started teaching in Seattle and in Fairbanks, Alaska, and in Colorado. But when the Colorado group said they wanted a resident teacher to come and stay there, I decided to move.
And in moving, you also decided to go back to Boulder, I guess, and get your master's degree in Buddhist studies?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Well, I was there in Colorado Springs, uh-huh. and I would occasionally drive up to Boulder, which was 100 miles north of us.
Okay.
And there heard about the monastic scholarship.
Hmm.
So I decided to apply and see, and I was accepted, and then needed a little vehicle, the same one I'm driving now.
All right.
Which now has 210,000 miles
wow.
on it.
Wow.
But I had to commute to Boulder generally twice a week, a 200-mile round trip.
Mm.
Which was very challenging in the spring snows, particularly.
I bet.
Going over mountain passes.
And while you're there, you have your sangha, you have your teachings going on, you're also getting your master's in Buddhist studies, and then were you contacted by the Air Force Academy?
Yes.
Or did you contact them?
They found me.
They found you, and they
yes.
said, we'd like you to be an Air Force Buddhist chaplain?
Yes.
Okay.
But I had to go through a lot of clearances. You
yes,
know,
I
the
bet.
Military.
Background checks and things.
Background checks and security clearances. And but I actually started there before I went to Boulder.
Okay.
There was a young cadet, one cadet,
mm-hmm.
who was very instrumental in starting the Buddhist group there. And I worked with him for 4 years
wow.
at the Air Force Academy. And the Buddhist group continues today. I was there for 5 years. Now Sarah Bender has continued the group in the Zen tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But I really, really enjoyed being with the cadets. If you have been to the U.S. Air Force Academy, it is up against the mountains, the Rocky Mountains, close to Pikes Peak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 7 or 10 miles from the gate to the chapel.
Wow.
So they are somewhat cloistered away, and I I jokingly do the analogy that the cadets and my life are very similar in the fact that they wear a uniform like I do. We have similar hairdos, and we have a code of ethics.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I really enjoyed working with them because they're somewhat isolated there.
Sure.
And work very hard.
How did you work with the first precept? Because as a Buddhist, the first precept we take is not to kill.
Yes.
And these men and women are being trained to be warriors.
Yes.
In the same way the historical Buddha came from the warrior caste. And so was there tension when it came to the fact that they might have to kill, whether it be drop bombs or use a rifle or whatever ways they kill?
These cadets, and this was pre-9/11,
mm-hmm.
when I started, so we were looking at a more idealistic philosophy towards their life as a an Air Force pilot or a military person. So this precept of not to kill, they also hold. They tell me, and it's come from different cadets over the years, that they are the last persons that want to engage in battle because they know the conditions of what they're getting into. And that they consider themselves peacekeepers. Now, you can take it any way you want from that. And so I would often discuss this area of birth, sickness, aging, and death, the condition of our human existence, and
yeah.
looking at that more than not to kill. No.
Okay.
Really having them try to look at what happens to this life as a human being, regardless mm-hmm. of if you're in a uniform or not.
Yeah.
Then 9/11 hit.
And everything changed.
Everything changed.
Yeah.
And it became extremely difficult to go through the security to get into the academy because they would check our cars, our engines, our trunks, put mirrors under our cars to see how they were. And so the clearance to get into the academy was much more tedious and
yeah.
Hard. But from what I understand, there really has been only a minimal drop-off of young men and women applying to the school. I think that there's there's still a huge number of young Americans and their parents, probably, who esteem the education that one can get at the academy.
Yeah.
And there's also a very strong, it's a difficult school to get into. Not only do you have to excel academically, but also you need to be strong physically and be have some affinity to the military life. So it really calls upon a certain kind of person
mm-hmm.
to even consider going there. However, for the cadets, the real dividing line comes at the end of their sophomore year when they can bow out and have no, what do you say, they're not obligated to fulfill any military service.
Okay.
But once they start on their junior year, then that's where they begin. They have to repay
okay.
the U.S. government. So I'm sure that's a big deciding point for them. Going back to this not to kill part, or even coming to my Buddhist group,
yeah.
It is really for the different thinker at the academy.
Okay.
There's such a sense of conformity in the way of how they're trained.
Yeah.
That those who come to the Buddhist group are very much different thinkers who are exploring their life and their experience in the academy in a different way. Mm. So I often found the way they thought very inspiring and was encouraged to be there. I was totally willing and enjoyed being with them.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And once a year, we would go, they called us the low numbers faiths groups.
Okay.
Which were the Jewish, Orthodox, Christian, and Buddhist groups. And we would do a retreat together. Because the Christian and Catholic groups were very large. So the low numbers faiths groups would have our own retreat time. And it was much more interfaith. We would discuss and have things planned events together.
Uh-huh.
We would go and visit each other's temples at different places in Denver. Recently, the people that I work with arranged an amazing meeting for those cadets who are interested to have a private meeting at the residence of Ken Wilber.
Wow.
And so they had a day
with
Ken.
One of my favorite guys.
Yes, and they had a day with Ken Wilber, and they're planning another one. And Ken Wilber talked about the nature of the human consciousness and the need for a military. So he spoke in a way that really encouraged the cadets in, you know, their lifestyle and their work. I wasn't there at that one, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But
and even King Ashoka, the famous Buddhist king,
yes,
didn't disband his military because he realized having a military was a way of protecting the citizens.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not like, I suppose we can get rid of them.
No.
Because the world would turn into chaos.
That's right.
So it's interesting that we have to come to a place of peace with that.
Yes.
If we want to keep our mental health.
Right.
Yeah. So how long were you in Colorado Springs?
I was in Colorado Springs for 7 years.
7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you decided to come back to Los Angeles?
I finished my degree at Naropa University.
Okay.
And decided, partly because of the economics of the group, there's a wonderful group of students always trying to sustain me in Colorado Springs, but it was quite challenging. And so I decided that perhaps it was a cooling out period, and it would be good to take a break after being there for 7 years, as I had gone there on a one-year trial.
Wow. Wow.
So I decided to do a three-month solitary retreat.
Okay.
And just before I entered retreat, we got word that His Holiness the Dalai Lama accepted our request to host his teachings here in Los Angeles again. So this was just last March, was it? And so I took on the coordinatorship of this visit, and so moved back to L.A. after my retreat.
Wow.
Yeah.
When is the Dalai Lama scheduled to come to Los Angeles? Do you remember?
Yes, he'll be here September, teaching September 12th, 13th, and 14th this fall, 2006.
And is there going to be a website if people who are listening to this podcast are interested? Can they contact you or your organization through the internet and say, I'd like some tickets?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So the website is www.tdling.com.
Okay.
For tuptendargeling.com.
Okay.
tdling.com. And there, when you enter the site, you can see the area for the Dalai Lama's visit. And all the details will be there. We have a contact form. You can put in any of your questions. We also have a voicemail phone number you can call in, and someone will reply to you. We'll also be selling tickets through Ticketmaster.
Okay, do you have the where the talks will take place?
Yes.
And will one be in Pasadena?
Yes, okay. 3 days of teachings will be at the Pasadena Civic Center on Green Street, and half of Wednesday, the Dalai Lama will be giving a public talk at the Gibson Amphitheater in Universal City. It used to be called the Universal Amphitheater.
Oh, yes,
but
yeah.
It's now called the Gibson Amphitheater.
Okay.
After the guitars.
Oh, Gibson guitars.
That's right.
Oh, they're good guitars.
Yes.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. So the public talk title is going to be Compassion, the Source of Happiness.
Ooh, what a good subject.
Yes.
Wonderful. Now, besides doing that, besides all the work that you're doing, arranging and laying out the Dalai Lama's agenda for when he's here, you're also in Santa Monica at the UCLA Medical Center, and you're taking training as a hospital chaplain.
That's right.
Yes, and I think that's just so cool. But before I ask you about that, what I'd really like to do is just for you to talk just a few minutes or less about when you had a medical problem and then you were facing a decision of what you needed to do to get past this medical problem and have your life going. And what I'm curious is about is how Buddhism helped you deal with your own medical issue. Mm-hmm. That did it give you hope? Did it give you acceptance? Did it give you clarity? Did it give you peace? Or none of those things?
It gave me a good reality check.
Okay.
When I was diagnosed with cancer, I thought, why me? I've been so good.
Exactly.
I've been practicing so well. Why me? And so a lot of self-cherishing and upset came initially. But the teachings really help when you go back again. You know, first noble truth of aging, sickness, and death, the inevitable. And this, I keep going back to the Four Noble Truths. They are infallible. They help me again and again. And I, you know, we keep going into this place of forgetting or denial or whatever we go into. But the teachings are so they just speak about the nature of reality. The nature of reality again and again and again. It's we who keep trying to infuse, you know, our own self-interest and self-plan in there. But the teachings on karma, the teachings on the nature of phenomena, the nature of our lives, just keep bringing me back again and again. And this, you know, our life is our teaching. Too. Our life is so is our teacher, and in this way I can keep going. And then to, you know, fast forward into what I'm doing now in hospital chaplaincy, I find the people in the hospital are my teachers too.
Now, those are the patients, or the nurses, and the doctors, the other chaplains?
The patients, particularly in having to deal with their own sickness, their suffering, their surgeries, their whatever is occurring for them. And some people are absolutely inspirational in the way they deal with the karmic throw of the nature of their body or the nature of their sickness, and other people are teachers for me in the way of saying, boy, you see their suffering even more when they are caught up in it with the complaints and the grumbling and the demands that come from a person who is suffering in sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And chaplaincy is just a wonderful practice. From being a teacher for so long, you know, it's almost like being in your ivory tower. But
okay.
When you're actually on the floor working with the patients, you have to deal heart to heart. You know, people, perhaps especially in their sickness, can see through inauthenticity right away. And
so you can't be a phony.
You can't be a phony, and so you watch your own aversion or your own heart going out to these people, or your own interest, you know, it's really and chaplaincy in California is great for someone who is wanting to learn more about interfaith traditions.
What are some of the challenges? Because you were kind enough, or the coordinator was kind enough to invite me over to speak to your group, and it was a lot of fun for me. But you do have a diverse chaplains group there.
Yes.
And how does everybody get along? Do they all sort of come to a place of acceptance with the diversity of religious views? Or is there some tension sometimes, or misunderstanding sometimes?
The particular group as it stands now is very harmonious.
Okay.
We're getting along wonderfully.
Great.
A couple people had dropped out, and I believe they had a conflict in interests and so moved on.
Yeah.
But I can see even on the floor when I'm working with the patients that there's an openness and an interest. Some people really want to go straight to the heart of their spiritual practice. And as a Buddhist nun who grew up in Hawaii in such a diverse community too, I have never said the Lord's Prayer so many times than I have in these last few months in chaplaincy. And I'm really enjoying it. I'm appreciating saying it and having the opportunity to say it with some people who pray with so much heart.
Yeah.
And I'm learning Jewish prayers and other healing prayers and working. I find the Buddhist prayers of loving kindness, the metta practice, loving kindness meditation, being wonderfully helpful for people in the hospitals, because they oftentimes people are lying down in bed with their pain and sickness, but they're so in their heads and they're thinking about their work to do or their families or what they couldn't do because of this accident, and they're so out of body and full of tension in their shoulders and in their minds, that the metta meditation particularly is very helpful to just bring them back, or to even have them rest on the breath so that they become embodied again, so to speak, you know, so that they come back to
the sort of present moment
experience.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So that they can enjoy connecting themselves, you know, for a moment.
Yeah.
And some of the discussions are really inspiring for me.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
One last question, and the question is, what do you see as some of the challenges for monastics who are growing older? You and I each year seem to get 1 year older, and whether we want to or not. And we were talking yesterday or the day before about the challenges of getting even health insurance sometimes. It's not available to us.
Right.
Are we going to have Social Security? Or are we going to be able to go to a rest home? Or will there be a temple or a center available to us? So as a Western monastic, and you've been ordained for how many years now?
Almost 21.
21 years. Congratulations. That's
Thank
wonderful.
You.
What do you see as some of the challenges for both of us as we go into our twilight years?
Yes. I think if we're really sincerely practicing, and perhaps the teachers have a different category somewhat, but there tends to be a group of people who esteem the Sangha and help. So even though we may have a very minimal stipend, I always seem to make it because people are very kind and helpful. But I am concerned about something like health insurance, which I've been denied as an individual. I think as aging monastics, unless we are involved in some group somewhere, some corporation, maybe in a larger working facility, we have to fend for ourselves, and this is daunting. And already we're challenged as being white crows. So we have a lot to work with, and I believe, you know, we're paving the way for the next group of monastics who'll come. And friends have approached me at different times as to how we can work around this and develop group insurance for monastics, regardless mm-hmm. what tradition we're in or what what center we're associated with. But it hasn't really gone very far. I haven't put too much energy into it. I think this is an important one.
So in a way, we're sort of pioneers. If we can figure out how to get old and die as a Buddhist monastic in America, the generations behind us will have that as a template in a real way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think as pioneers, we also have to really practice as well as we can
yeah.
with being in the 21st century, being educated in the Western school system as well as the Buddhist traditions, mm-hmm. that we need to synthesize what we can and really pave our own way besides paving the way for others. It is a very exciting time
mm-hmm.
to be a monastic, because we're not encrusted by formality and tradition, that we do need to keep our eyes open as to working with greater conscientiousness and clarity.
Yeah.
That we're doing things and not just setting the stage for more rigidity
mm-hmm.
in formal practice. Not practice in meditation, but practice in the way of lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. So we're not burdened with the centuries of tradition. In America, we're so new here, and we're still trying to figure it out. And as we bring the teachings to others who are interested in English, so they don't have to learn Tibetan or they don't have to learn Sanskrit, that we can impact them in a very special way. In the way each culture yes. has impacted their Buddhists.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
Yeah, by making Buddhism theirs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. There is a comment, you know, as being really good practitioners too, that I've read in the text somewhere, which is so sweet, that they say, if you're really practicing well, you know, and you're in the mountains somewhere, meditating, that if your practice is sincere, the noodles will even roll up to you, and that you don't even have to go down for your food.
I like that. That's good.
And I think it's true, you know, as a beautiful symbol of sincere practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I really mean this for for people regardless if they're monastics or not.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Could you share with us one more time the name of the center where you live in Long Beach, mm-hmm. and also the website, so they could, if they're interested in finding out more about you or the center or the Dalai Lama and his tour, they could come to
www.tdling.com.
Okay.
And just enter the site, and there'll be other links to the Dalai Lama's visit this coming September 12th, 13th, 14th, 2006 in Los Angeles. And there's also a voicemail, too. So that voicemail number is 213-987-2927. That's a voicemail number. So you can get information about the visit there as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for letting me sit down with you and ask you questions.
Well, it's always a pleasure.
And it was a lot of fun. And I guess that's it. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, too.
Well, that's it. That was my interview with Venerable Tenzin Kacho in Long Beach, California, on April 1st, 2006. Hope you found it interesting. Hope you found it useful. If you'd like more information on me, please visit my website, kusala.info, kusala.info. And please feel free to email me. I've received emails now from all over the world commenting on my podcasts. If you have a comment or a suggestion, please drop me an email and let me know. kusala@urbandharma.org. And speaking of urbandharma.org, that's my Buddhist website, over 1,500 pages of Buddhist information. If you haven't been there yet, please drop by. I think you'll find it useful. So until the next time, until the next podcast, be happy, be peaceful, and most of all, be free from suffering.